think I teach history. I'll let other people make it. It's like being a reporter. Ryan smiled. I get to criticize people long after they make their decisions. That doesn't mean I know what to do today. But you knew what to do on Tuesday, the Times pointed out. Ryan shrugged. Yeah, I guess I did, Ryan said on the television screen. You clever bastard, Kevin Joseph O'Donnell muttered into a glass of dark Guinness beer. His base of operations was much farther from the border than any might have suspected. Ireland is a small country, and distances are but relative things, particularly to those with all the resources they need. His former colleagues in the PIRA had extensive safe houses along the border, convenient to a quick trip across from either direction. Not for O'Donnell. There were numerous practical reasons. The Brits had their informers and intelligence people there, always creeping about, and the SAS raiders, who were not averse to a quick snatch, or a quiet kill, of persons who had made the mistake of becoming too well known. The border could be a convenience to either side. A more serious threat was the PIRA itself, which also watched the border closely. His face, altered as it was with some minor surgery and a change in hair color, might still be recognizable to a former colleague. But not here. And the border wasn't all that far a drive in a country barely 300 miles long. He turned away from the Sony television and gazed out the leaded glass windows to the darkness of the sea. He saw the running lights of a car ferry inbound from Le Havre. The view was always a fine one. Even in the limited visibility of an ocean storm, one could savor the fundamental force of nature as the gray waves battered the rocky cliff. Now the clear, cold air gave him a view to the star-defined horizon, and he spied another merchant ship heading eastward for an unknown port. It pleased O'Donnell that this stately house on the headlands had once belonged to a British lord. It pleased him more that he'd been able to purchase it through a dummy corporation, that there were few questions when cash and a reputable solicitor were involved. So vulnerable, this society. All societies were when you had the proper resources, and a competent tailor. So shallow they were, so lacking in political awareness. One must know who one's enemies are, O'Donnell told himself at least 10 times every day. Not a liberal, democratic society, though. Enemies were people to be dealt with, compromised with, to be civilized, brought into the fold, co-opted. Fools. Self-destructive, ignorant fools who earned their own destruction. Someday they would all disappear, just as one of those ships slid beneath the horizon. History was a science, an inevitable process. O'Donnell was sure of that. He turned again to stare into the fire burning under the wide stone mantle. There had once been stag heads hanging over it, perhaps the Lord's favorite fowling piece. From Purdy's, to be sure. And a painting or two. Of horses, O'Donnell was sure. They had to be paintings of horses. The country gentleman who had built this house, he mused, would have been someone who'd been given everything he had. No ideology would have intruded in his empty, useless head. He would have sat in a chair very like this one and sipped his malt whiskey and stared into the fire, his favorite dog at his feet, while he chatted about the day's hunting with a neighbor and planned the hunting for the morrow. Will it be birds again or fox, Bertie? Haven't had a good fox hunt in weeks. Time we did it again, don't you think? Or something like that, he was sure. O'Donnell wondered if there was a seasonal aspect to it, or had the Lord just done whatever suited his mood. The current owner of the country house never hunted animals. What was the point of killing something that could not harm you or your cause, something that had no ideology? Besides, that was something the Brits did, something the local gentry still did. He didn't hunt the local Irish gentry. They weren't worth his contempt, much less his action. At least, Not yet. You don't hate trees, he told himself. You ignore the things until you have to cut them down. He turned back to the television. That Ryan fellow was still there, he saw, talking amiably with the press idiots. Bloody hero. Why did you stick your nose in where it doesn't belong? Reflex, sounds like, O'Donnell judged. Bloody meddling fool. Don't even know what's going on, do you? None of you do. Americans. The Provo fools still like to talk it up with your kind, telling their lies and pretending that they represent Ireland. What do you Yanks know about anything? Oh, but we can't afford to offend the Americans, the provost still said. Bloody Americans, with all their money and all their arrogance, all their ideas on right and wrong, their childish vision of Irish destiny. Like children dressed up for First Communion, so pure, so naive, so useless with their trickle of money. For all that the Brits complained about NORAID, O'Donnell knew that the PIRA had not netted $1 million from America in the past 3 years. All the Americans knew of Ireland came from a few movies, some half-remembered songs for St. Paddy's Day, and the occasional bottle of whiskey. What did they know of life in Ulster, of the imperialist oppression, the way all Ireland was still enslaved to the decaying British Empire, which was in turn enslaved to the American one? What did they know about anything? But we can't offend the Americans. The leader of the ULA finished off his beer and set it on the end table. The cause didn't require much, not really. A clear ideological objective, a few good men. Friends, the right friends, with access to the right resources. That was all. Why clutter things up with bloody Americans? And a public political wing. Sinn Féin electing people to Parliament, what rubbish! They were waiting, hoping to be co-opted by the Brit imperialists. Valuable political targets declared off-limits. And people wondered why the provos were getting nowhere. Their ideology was bankrupt, and there were too many people in the brigade. When the Brits caught some, a few were bound to turn tout and inform on their comrades. The kind of commitment needed for this sort of job demanded an elite few. O'Donnell had that, all right. And you need to have the right plan, he told himself with a wispy smile. O'Donnell had his plan. This Ryan fellow hadn't changed that, he reminded himself. Bastard's bloody pleased with himself, isn't he? O'Donnell turned to see a fresh bottle of Guinness offered. He took it and refilled his glass. Sean should have watched his back. Then this bloody hero would be a corpse. And the mission would have been successful. Damn. We can still do something about that, sir. O'Donnell shook his head. We do not waste our energy on the insignificant. The provos have been doing that for 10 years, and look where it has gotten them. What if he is CIA? What if we've been infiltrated, and he was there? Don't be a bloody fool, O'Donnell snapped. If they'd been tipped, every peeler in London would have been there in plain clothes waiting for us. And I would have known beforehand, he didn't say. Only one other member of the organization knew of his source, and he was in London. It was luck. Good for them, bad for us. Just luck. We were lucky in your case, weren't we, Michael? Like any Irishman, he still believed in luck. Ideology would never change that. The younger man thought of his 18 months in the H-blocks at Longkesh Prison, and was silent. O'Donnell shrugged at the television as the news program changed to another story. Luck. That was all. Some moneyed Yank with too long a nose who'd gotten very lucky. Any random event, like a punctured tire, a defective radio battery, or a sudden rainstorm, could have made the operation fail too. and his advantage over the other side was that they had to be lucky all the time. O'Donnell only had to be lucky once. He considered what he had just seen on the television and decided that Ryan wasn't worth the effort. Mustn't offend the Americans, he thought to himself again, this time with surprise. Why? Aren't they the enemy, too? Patrick, me boy, now you're thinking like those idiots in the PIRA. Patience is the most important quality in the true revolutionary. One must wait for the proper moment, and then strike decisively. He waited for his next intelligence report. The rare bookshop was in the Burlington Arcade, a century-old promenade of shops off the most fashionable part of Piccadilly. It was sandwiched between one of London's custom tailors. This one catered mainly to the tourists who used the arcade to shelter from the elements, and a jeweler. It had the sort of smell that draws bibliophiles as surely as the scent of nectar draws a bee, the musty, dusty odor of dried-out paper and leather binding. The shop's owner-operator was contrastingly young, dressed in a suit whose shoulders were sprinkled with dust. He started every day by running a feather duster over the shelves, and the books were ever exuding new quantities of it. He had grown to like it. The store had an ambiance that he dearly loved. The store did a small but lucrative volume of business, depending less on tourists than on a discreet number of regular customers from the upper reaches of London society. The owner, a Mr. Dennis Cooley, travelled a great deal, often flying out on short notice to participate in an auction of some deceased gentleman's library, leaving the shop to the custody of a young lady who would have been quite pretty if she'd worked at it a little harder. Beatrix was off today. Mr. Cooley had an ancient teak desk in keeping with the rest of the shop's motif, and even a cushionless swivel chair to prove to the customers that nothing in the shop was modern. Even the bookkeeping was done by hand. No electronic calculators here. A battered ledger book dating back to the 1930s listed thousands of sales, and the shop's book catalog was made of simple filing cards in small wooden boxes, one set listing books by title and another by author. All writing was done with a gold-nibbed fountain pen. A no-smoking sign was the only modern touch. The smell of tobacco might have ruined the shop's unique aroma. The store's stationery bore the By Appointment To crests of four royal family members. The arcade was but a 10-minute uphill walk from Buckingham Palace. The glass door had a 100-year-old silver bell hanging on the top of the frame. It rang.
"Good morning, Mr. Cooley."
"And to you, sir," Dennis answered one of his regulars as he stood. He had an accent so neutral that his customers had him pegged as a native of three different regions. "I have the first edition, Defoe, the one you called about earlier this week. Just came in yesterday."
"Is this the one from that collection in Cork you spoke about?"
"No, sir. I believe it's originally from the estate of Sir John Claggett, near Swaffham Prior. I found it at Hawstead's in Cambridge."
"A first edition?"
"Most certainly, sir."
The book dealer did not react noticeably. The code phrase was both constant and changing. Cooley made frequent trips to Ireland, both north and south, to purchase books from the estates of deceased collectors or from dealers in the country. When the customer mentioned any country in the Irish Republic, he indicated the destination for his information. When he questioned the edition of the book, he also indicated its importance. Cooley pulled the book off the shelf and set it on his desk. The customer opened it with care, running his finger down the title page. "In an age of paperbacks and half-bound books..."
"Indeed," Cooley nodded. Both men's love for the art of bookbinding was genuine. Any good cover becomes more real than its builders expect. "The leather is in remarkable shape."
His visitor grunted agreement.
"I must have it."
"How much?" The dealer didn't answer. Instead, Cooley removed the card from the box and handed it to his customer.
He gave the card only a cursory look. Done. The customer sat down in the store's only other chair and opened his briefcase. I have another job for you. This is an early copy of The Vicar of Wakefield. I found it last month at a little shop in Cornwall. He handed the book over. Cooley needed only a single look at its condition. Scandalous.
Can your chap restore it?
I don't know. The leather was cracked, some of the pages had been dog-eared, and the binding was frayed almost to non-existence. I'm afraid the attic in which they found it had a leaky roof, the customer said casually. Oh, is the information that important? Cooley looked up. A tragic waste.
How else can you explain it?
The man shrugged.
I'll see what I can do. He's not a miracle worker, you know.
Is it that important?
I understand. Still, the best you can arrange.
Yes, it's that important.
Of course, sir.
Cooley opened his desk drawer and withdrew the cash box. This customer always paid cash. Of course. He removed the wallet from his suit coat and counted out the 50-pound notes. Cooley checked the amount, then placed the book in a stout cardboard box, which he tied with string. No plastic bags for this shop. Seller and buyer shook hands. The transfer was complete. The customer walked south toward Piccadilly, then turned right, heading west toward Green Park and downhill to the palace. Cooley took the envelope that had been hidden in the book and tucked it away in a drawer. He finished making his ledger entry, then called his travel agent to book a flight to Cork, where he would meet a fellow dealer in rare books and have lunch at the Old Bridge restaurant before catching a flight home. Beatrix would have to manage the shop tomorrow. It did not occur to him to open the envelope. That was not his job. The less he knew, the less was vulnerable if he were caught. Cooley had been trained by professionals, and the first rule pounded into his head had been need to know. He ran the intelligence operation, and he needed to know how to do that. He didn't always need to know what specific information he gathered.
Hello, Dr. Ryan. It was an American voice, with a South Bay Boston accent that Jack remembered from his college days. It sounded good. The man was in his 40s, a wiry, athletic frame with thinning black hair. He had a flower box tucked under his arm. Whoever he was, the cop outside had opened the door for him.
Howdy. Who might you be?
Dan Murray. I'm the legal attaché at the embassy. FBI, he explained. Sorry I couldn't get down sooner, but things have been a little busy.
Murray showed his ID to the cop sitting in with Ryan. Tony Wilson was off duty. The cop excused himself. Murray took his seat.
Looking good, Ace.
You could have left the flowers at the main desk.
Ryan gestured around the room. Despite all his efforts to spread the flowers about, he could barely see the walls for all the roses.
Yeah, I figured that. How's the grub?
Hospital food is hospital food.
Figured that, too.
Murray removed the red ribbon and opened the box.
How does a Whopper and fries grab you? You have a choice of vanilla or chocolate shakes.
Jack laughed and grabbed.
I've been over here 3 years, Murray said. Every so often I have to hit the fast food joints to remind myself where I come from. You can get tired of lamb. The local beer's pretty good, though.
I'd have brought a few of those, but,
well, you know.
You just made a friend for life, Mr. Murray, even without the beer.
Dan!
Jack.
Ryan was tempted to wolf down the burger for fear of having a nurse come through the door and throw an immediate institutional fit.
No, he decided. I'll enjoy this one.
He selected the vanilla shake.
The local guys say you broke records identifying me.
No big deal.
Murray poked a straw into the chocolate one.
By the way, I bring you greetings from the ambassador. He wanted to come over, but they have a big-time party for later tonight.
and my friends down the hall send their regards to.
Who down the hall?
The people you have never worked for.
The FBI agent raised his eyebrows.
Oh. Jack swallowed a few fries. Who the hell broke that story?
Washington. Some reporter was having lunch with somebody's aide. It doesn't really matter whose, does it? They all talk too much.
Evidently, he remembered your name in the back of the final report and couldn't keep his trap shut.
Apologies from Langley, they told me to tell you. I saw the TV stuff. You dodged that pretty good.
I told the truth. Barely. All my checks came through MITRE Corporation. Some sort of bookkeeping thing, and MITRE had the consulting contract.
I understand all your time was at Langley, though.
Yeah, a little cubbyhole on the third floor with a desk, a computer terminal, and a scratch pad. Ever been there?
Murray smiled.
Once or twice. I'm in the terrorism business, too. The Bureau has a much nicer decorator. Helps to have a PR department, don't you know?
Murray affected a caricatured London accent.
I saw a copy of the report. Nice work. How much of it did you do?
Most. It wasn't all that hard. I just came up with a new angle to look at it from.
It's been passed along to the Brits. I mean, it came over here 2 months ago for the Secret Intelligence Service. I understand they liked it.
So their cops know.
I'm not sure.
Well, you can probably assume they do now. Owens is cleared all the way on this stuff.
And so's Ashley.
He's a little on the snotty side, but he's damn smart.
He's 5.
What?
Ryan didn't know that one.
He's in MI5, the security service. We just call it 5. Has a nice insider feel that way.
Murray chuckled.
I figured him for something like that. The other two started as street cops. It shows.
It struck a few people as slightly curious. The guy who wrote Agents and Agencies gets stuck in the middle of a terrorist op.
That's why Ashley showed up.
Murray shook his head. You wouldn't believe all the coincidences you run into in my business.
Like you and me.
I know you come from New England. Oh, don't tell me. Boston College?
Hey, I always wanted to be an FBI agent. It was either BC or Holy Cross, right?
Murray grinned. That in-house FBI joke went back 2 generations and was not without a few grains of truth.
Ryan leaned back and sucked the shake up the straw. It tasted wonderful.
How much do we know about these ULA guys? Jack asked.
I never saw very much at Langley.
Not a hell of a lot. The boss man's a chap named Kevin O'Donnell. He used to be in the PIRA. He started throwing rocks in the streets and supposedly worked his way up to head counterintelligence man. The provos are pretty good at that.
Have to be.
The Brits are always working to infiltrate the organization. The word is that he got a little carried away cleansing the ranks and barely managed to skip out before they gave him Excedrin headache number 357. Just plain disappeared and hasn't been spotted since.
A few sketchy reports, like maybe he spent some time in Libya, like maybe he's back in Ulster with a new face, like maybe he has a lot of money.
Want to guess where from? To throw around.
All we know for sure is that he's one malignant son of a bitch.
His organization?
Murray set the milkshake down.
It's gotta be small, probably less than 30. We think he had part of the breakout from Long Kesh last summer. 11 hardcore provos got out. The RUC bagged one of them 2 days later, and he said that 6 of the 11 went south, probably to Kevin's outfit. He was a little pissed by that. They were supposed to come back to the PIRA fold, but somebody convinced them to try something different. Some very bad boys. They had a total of 15 murders among them. The one you killed is the only one to show up since.
Are they that good? Ryan asked.
Hey, the PIRA are the best terrorists in the world, unless you count those bastards in Lebanon, and those are mostly family groups. Hell of a way to describe them, isn't it? But they are the best. well-organized, well-trained, and they believe, if you know what I mean. They really care about what they're doing. The level of commitment these characters have to the cause is something you have to see to believe.
You've been in on it?
Some. I've been able to sit in on interrogations. The other side of the two-way mirror, I mean. One of these guys wouldn't talk, wouldn't even give him his name for a week. Just sat there like a sphinx. Hey, I've chased after bank robbers, kidnappers, mob guys, spies, you name it. These fellas are real pros. And that's the PIRA. Maybe 500 real members, not even as big as a New York Mafia family. And the RUC, that's the Royal Ulster Constabulary, the local cops, is lucky to convict a handful in a year. They have a law of omerta up there that would impress the old-time Sicilians. But at least the cops have a handle on who the bastards are. The ULA, we got a couple of names, a few pictures, and that's it. It's almost like the Islamic Jihad bums. You only know them from what they do.
What do they do? Ryan asked.
They seem to specialize in high-risk, high-profile operations. It took over a year to confirm that they exist at all. We thought they were a special action group of the PIRA. They're an anomaly within the terrorist community. They don't make press releases. They don't take public credit for what they do. They go for the big-time stuff, and they cover their tracks like you wouldn't believe. It takes resources to do that. Somebody is bankrolling them in a pretty big way. They've been identified for 9 jobs, we're sure of. Maybe 2 others. They've only had 3 operations go bad. Quite a track record. They missed killing a judge in Londonderry because the RPG round was a dud. It still took his bodyguard out. They tried to hit a police barracks last February. Somebody saw them setting up and phoned in, but the bastards must have been monitoring the police radio. They skipped before the cavalry arrived. The cops found an 82mm mortar and a box of rounds, high explosive and white phosphorus to be exact. And you got in the way of the last one. These suckers are getting pretty bold, Murray said. On the other hand, we got one now.
We? Ryan said curiously. It's not our fight.
We're talking terrorists, Jack. Everybody wants them. We swap information back and forth with the Yard every day. Anyway, the guy they have in the can right now, they'll keep talking at him. They have a hook on this one. The ULA is an outcast outfit. He is going to be a pariah, and he knows it. His colleagues from PIRA and INLA won't circle wagons around him. He'll go to a maximum security prison, probably to one on the Isle of Wight, populated with some real bad boys. Not all of them are political types, and the ordinary robbers and murderers will probably... Well, it's funny how patriotic these guys are. Spies, for example, have about as much fun in the joint as child molesters. This guy went after the royal family, the one thing over here that everybody loves. We're talking some serious hard time with this kid. You think the guards are going to bust their ass looking out for his well-being? He's going to learn a whole new sport. It's called survival. After he has a taste of it, people will talk to him. Sooner or later, that kid's going to have to decide just how committed he is. He just might break down a little. Some have. That's what we play for, anyway. The bad guys have the initiative. We have organization and procedures. If they make a mistake, give us an opportunity, we can act on it.
Ryan nodded.
Yeah. It's all intelligence. That's right. Without the right information, we're crippled. All we can do is plod along and hope for a break. But give us one solid fact and we'll bring the whole friggin' world down on them. It's like taking down a brick wall. The hard part's getting that first brick loose.
And where do they get their information?
They told me you tumbled to that, Murray observed with a smile. I don't think it was a chance encounter. Somebody had to tip them. They hit a moving target making an unscheduled trip.
How the hell did you know that? The agent demanded.
Doesn't matter, does it? People talk. Who knew that they were coming in?
That is being looked at. The interesting thing is what they were coming in for.
Of course, that could just be a coincidence. The prince gets briefed on political and national security stuff, same as the queen does. Something happened with the Irish situation, negotiations between London and Dublin. He was coming in for a briefing. All I can tell you. Hey, if you checked me out, you know how I'm cleared, Ryan sniffed. Murray grinned. Nice try, Ace. If you weren't cleared TS, I wouldn't have told you this much. We're not privy to it yet anyway. Like I said, it might just have been a coincidence, but you guessed right on the important part. It was an unscheduled trip, and somebody got the word out for the ambush. Only way it could have happened. You will consider that classified information, Dr. Ryan. It doesn't go past that door. Murray was affable. He was also very serious about his job. Jack nodded agreement. No problem. It was a kidnap, too, wasn't it? The FBI agent grimaced and shook his head. I've handled about a half dozen kidnappings and closed every case with a conviction. We only lost one hostage. They killed that kid the first day. Those two were executed. I watched, Murray said coldly. Kidnapping is a high-risk crime all the way down the line. They have to be at a specific place to get their money. That's usually what gets them caught. We can track people like you wouldn't believe, then bring in the cavalry hard and fast. In this case, we're talking some impressive bargaining chips, and there would not be a money transfer. The public release of some political prisoners is the obvious objective. The evidence does lean that way, except that these characters have never done one of those. It makes the escape procedures a lot more complex, but these ULA characters have always had their escape routes well planned beforehand. I'd say you're probably right, but it's not as clear-cut as you think.
Owens and Taylor aren't completely sure, and our friend isn't talking. Big surprise. They've never made a public announcement, you said? Was this supposed to be their break into the big time? Their first public announcement? They might as well do it with something spectacular, Ryan said thoughtfully.
That's a fair guess, Murray nodded. It certainly would have put them on the map. Like I said, our intel on these chaps is damn thin. Almost all of it's second-hand stuff that comes through the PIRA, which is why we thought they were actually part of it. We haven't exactly figured what they're up to. Every one of their operations has... How do I say this? There seems to be a pattern there, but nobody's ever figured it out. It's almost as though the political fallout isn't aimed at us at all, but that doesn't make any sense.
Not that it has to make sense, the agent grunted. It's not easy trying to psychoanalyze the terrorist mind.
Any chance they'll come after me, or... Murray shook his head. Unlikely, and the security's pretty tight. You know who they have taken your wife and kid around?
S.A.S., I asked.
That youngster's on their Olympic pistol team, and I hear that he has some field experience that never made the papers. The DPG escort is also one of the varsity, and they'll have a chase car everywhere they go. The security on you is pretty impressive, too. You have some big league interest in your safety. You can relax. And after you get home, it's all behind you. None of these groups has ever operated in the U.S., we're too important to them. NORAID means more to them psychologically than financially. When they fly to Boston, it's like crawling back into the womb, all the beers people buy for them. It tells them that they're the good guys. Now, if they started raising hell out our side of the pond, I don't think they could take being persona non grata in Boston. It's the only real weak point the PIRA and the rest have, and unfortunately it's not one that we can exploit all that well. We've pretty much cut down on the weapons pipeline, but hell, they get most of their stuff from the other side now. Or they make their own. Like explosives. All you need is a bag of ammonia-based fertilizer and you can make a respectable bomb. You can't arrest a farmer for carrying fertilizer in his truck, can you? It's not as sexy as some good plastique, but it's a hell of a lot easier to get. For guns and heavier stuff, anybody can get AK-47s and RPGs. They're all over the place. No, they depend on us for moral support, and there's quite a few people who will give it, even in Congress. Remember the fight over the extradition treaty? It's amazing. These bastards kill people. Both sides.
Murray paused for a moment. The Protestant crazies are just as bad. The provisionals waste the prod. Then the Ulster Volunteer Force sends a car through a Catholic neighborhood and pops the first convenient target. A lot of the killing is purely random now. Maybe a third of the kills are people who were walking down the wrong street. The process feeds on itself, and there's not much of a middle ground left anymore. Except the cops. I know, the RUC used to be the bad guys, too, but they've just about ended that crap. The law has got to be the law for everyone. But that's too easy to forget sometimes. Like in Mississippi back in the 60s, and that's essentially what happened in Northern Ireland.
Sir Jack Herman is trying to turn the RUC into a professional police force. There are plenty of people left over from the bad old days, but the troops are coming around.
They must be. The cops are taking casualties from both sides. The last one was killed by prods.
They firebombed his house.
Murray shook his head.
It's amazing. I was just over there 2 weeks ago. Their morale's great, especially with the new kids.
I don't know how they do it.
Well, I do know. They have their mission, too. The cops and the courts have to reestablish justice, and the people have to see that they're doing it. They're the only hope that place has, them and a few of the church leaders. Maybe common sense'll break out someday, but don't hold your breath. It's going to take a long time. Thank God for Tom Jefferson and Jim Madison, bub. Sometimes I wonder how close we came to that sectarian stuff. It's like a mafia war that everybody can play in.
Well, Judge, Admiral James Greer hit the off switch on the remote control as the cable news network switched topics. The director of Central Intelligence tapped his cigar on the cut glass ashtray. We know he's smart, James, and it looks like he knows how to handle himself with reporters. But he's impetuous, Judge Arthur Moore said.
Come on, Arthur.
He's young. I want somebody in here with some fresh ideas. You going to tell me now that you didn't like his report? First time at bat, and he turns out something that good.
Judge Moore smiled behind his cigar. It was drizzling outside the seventh floor window of the office of the Deputy Director, Intelligence, of the Central Intelligence Agency. The rolling hills of the Potomac Valley prevented his seeing the river, but he could spy the hills a mile or so away on the far side. It was a far prettier view than that of the parking lots.
Background check.
We haven't done a deep one yet, but I'll bet you a bottle of your favorite bourbon that he comes up clean.
No bet, James.
Moore had already seen Jack's service record from the Marine Corps. Besides, he hadn't come to the agency. They had gone to him, and he'd turned them down on the first offer.
You think he can handle it, huh?
You really ought to meet the kid, Judge. I had him figured out the first 10 minutes he was in here last July.
You arranged the leak?
Me? Leak?
Admiral Greer chuckled.
Nice to know how he can handle himself, though, isn't it?
Didn't even blink when he fielded the question. The boy takes his clearance seriously, and... Greer held up the telex from London. He's asking good questions. Emil says his man Murray was fairly impressed, too. It's just a damn shame to waste him teaching history.
Even at your alma mater?
Greer smiled.
Yes, that does hurt a little.
I want him, Arthur. I want to teach him. I want to groom him. He's our kind of people.
But he doesn't seem to think so.
He will.
Greer was quietly positive.
Okay, James. How do you want to approach him?
No hurry. I want a very thorough background check done first. And who knows? Maybe he'll come to us.
No chance, Judge Moore scoffed.
He'll come to us requesting information on this ULA bunch, Greer said.
The judge thought about that one.
One thing about James Greer, Moore knew, was his ability to see into things and people as though they were made of crystal.
That makes sense.
You bet it does. It'll be a while. The attaché says he has to stay over for the trial and all, but he'll be in this office 2 weeks after he gets back, asking for a chance to research this ULA outfit. If he does, I'll pop the offer. If you agree, Arthur. I also want to talk to Emil Jacobs at FBI and compare files on these ULA characters.
Okay.
They turned to other matters.
Chapter 5. Perks and Plots. The day Ryan was released from the hospital was the happiest in his life, at least since Sally had been born at Johns Hopkins 4 years before. It was after 6 in the evening when he finally finished dressing himself. The cast made that a very tricky exercise, and plopped down in the wheelchair. Jack had groused about that, but it was evidently a rule as inviolable in British hospitals as in American ones. Patients are not allowed to walk out. Somebody might think they were cured. A uniformed policeman pushed him out of the room into the hall. Ryan didn't look back. Virtually the whole floor staff was lined up in the hall, along with a number of the patients Ryan had met the past week and a half as he'd relearned how to walk up and down the drab corridors, with the 10-degree list from the heavy cast. Jack flushed red at the applause, the more so when people reached out to shake his hand. I'm not an Apollo astronaut, he thought. The Brits are supposed to be more dignified than this. Nurse Kittywake gave a little speech about what a model patient he was. What a pleasure and an honor. Ryan blushed again when she finished, and gave him some flowers to take to his lovely wife, she said. Then she kissed him, on behalf of everyone else. Jack kissed back. It was the least he could do, he told himself, and she really was a pretty girl. Kittywake hugged him, cast and all, and tears started running out of her eyes. Tony Wilson was at her side and gave Jack a surreptitious wink. That was no surprise. Jack shook hands with another 10 or so people before the cop got him into the elevator. Next time you guys find me wounded in the street, Ryan said, let me die there. The policeman laughed. Bloody ungrateful fellow you are. True. The elevator opened at the lobby, and he was grateful to see that it had been cleared, except for the Duke of Edinburgh and a gaggle of security people. Good evening, my lord. Ryan tried to stand, but was waved back down. Hello, Jack. How are you feeling? They shook hands, and for a moment he was afraid that the Duke himself would wheel him out the door. That would have been intolerable, but the police officer resumed his pushing as the Duke walked alongside. Jack pointed forward. Sir, I will improve at least 50% when we make it through that door. Hungry? After hospital food? I just might eat one of your polo horses. The Duke grinned. We'll try to do a little better than that. Jack noticed 7 security people in the lobby. Outside was a Rolls-Royce, and at least 4 other cars, along with a number of people who did not look like ordinary passers-by. It was too dark to see anyone prowling the roofs, but they'd be there, too. Well, Ryan thought, they've learned their lessons on security. Still a damned shame, though, and it means the terrorists have won a victory. If they make society change even a little, they've won something. Bastards. The cop brought him right to the rolls. Can I get up now? The cast was so heavy that it ruined his balance. Ryan stood a little too fast and nearly smashed into the car, but caught himself with an angry shake of the head before anyone had to grab for him. He stood still for a moment, his left arm sticking out like the big claw on a fiddler crab, and tried to figure how to get into the car. It turned out that the best way was to stick the cast in first, then rotate clockwise as he followed it. The Duke had to enter from the other side, and it turned out to be rather a snug fit. Ryan had never been in a Rolls before, and found that it wasn't all that spacious. Comfortable? Well, I'll have to be careful not to punch a window out with this damn thing.
Ryan leaned back and shook his head with an eyes-closed smile.
You really are glad to be out of hospital. My lord, on that you can wager one of your castles. This makes 3 times I've been in a body and fender shop, and that's enough. The Duke motioned for the driver to pull out. The convoy moved slowly into the street, 2 lead cars and 2 chase cars surrounding the Rolls-Royce.
Sir, may I ask what's happening this evening?
Very little, really. A small party, in your honor, with just a few close friends.
Jack wondered what a few close friends meant. 20, 50, 100? He was going to dinner at...
Scotty, beam me up.
Sir, you know that you've really been too kind to us.
Bloody rubbish.
Aside from the debt we owe you, not exactly what one would call a small debt, Jack. Aside from that, it's been entirely worthwhile to meet some new people. I even finished your book Sunday night. I thought it was excellent. You must send me a copy of your next one. And the Queen and your wife have got on marvelously. You are a very lucky chap to have a wife like that. And that little imp of a daughter. She's a gem, Jack. A thoroughly wonderful little girl. Ryan nodded. He often wondered what he had done to be so lucky. Kathy says that she's seen about every castle in the realm, and thanks a lot for the people you put with her. It made me feel much better about having them run all over the place. The Duke waved his hand dismissively. It wasn't worth talking about.
How did the research go on your new book?
Quite well, sir. The one favorable result of his being in the hospital was that he'd had the time to sift through all of it in detail. His computer had 200 new pages of notes stored in its bubble chips, and Ryan had a new perspective on judging the actions of others. I guess I've learned one thing from my little escapade. Sitting in front of a keyboard isn't quite the same as looking into the front end of a gun. Decisions are a little different from that perspective. Ryan's tone made a further statement. The Duke clapped him on the knee.
I shouldn't think that anyone will fault yours.
Maybe. The thing is, my decision was made on pure instinct. If I'd known what I was doing... What if I had done the wrong thing on instinct? He looked out the window. Here I am, supposed to be an expert on naval history, with special emphasis on how decisions are made under stress, and I'm still not satisfied with my own.
Damn.
Jack concluded quietly. Sir, you don't forget killing somebody. You just don't.
You oughtn't to dwell on it, Jack.
Yes, sir. Ryan turned back from the window. The Duke was looking at him much the same way his father had years before. A conscience is the price of morality, and morality is the price of civilization. Dad used to say that many criminals don't have a conscience, not much in the way of feelings at all. I guess that's what makes us different from them.
Exactly. Your introspection is a fundamentally healthy thing, but you should not overdo it. Put it behind you, Jack.
It was my impression of Americans that you prefer to look to the future rather than the past. If you cannot do that professionally, at least try to do it personally.
Understood, sir. Thank you. Now, if I could just make the dreams stop.
Nearly every night Jack relived the shootout on the Mall. Almost 3 weeks now. Something else they didn't tell you about on TV. The human mind has a way of punishing itself for killing a fellow man. It remembers and relives the incident again and again. Ryan hoped it would stop someday. The car turned left onto Westminster Bridge. Jack hadn't known exactly where the hospital was, just that it was close to a railway station and close enough to Westminster to hear Big Ben toll the hours. He looked up at the Gothic stonework.
You know, besides the research I wanted to do, I actually wanted to see part of your country, sir.
Not much time left for that.
Jack,
Do you really think we will let you return to America without experiencing British hospitality? The Duke was greatly amused.
We are quite proud of our hospitals, of course, but tourists don't come here to see those. Some small arrangements have been made.
Oh. Ryan had to think a moment to figure where they were, but the maps he'd studied before coming over came back to him. It was called Birdcage Walk. It was only 300 yards from where he'd been shot. There was the lake that Sally liked. He could see Buckingham Palace past the head of the security officer in the left front seat. Knowing that he was going there was one thing, but now the building loomed in front of him and the emotional impact started to take hold. They entered the palace grounds at the northeast gate. Jack hadn't seen the palace before, except from a distance. The perimeter security didn't seem all that impressive, but the palace's hollow square design hid nearly everything from outside view. There could easily be a company of armed troops inside. And who could tell? More likely civilian police, Ryan knew, backed up by a lot of electronic hardware. But there would be some surprises hidden away, too. After the scares in the past and this latest incident, he imagined that this place was as secure as the White House. Or even better, given greater space in and around the buildings.
It was too dark to make out many details, but the rolls pulled through an archway into the building's courtyard, then under a canopy, where a sentry snapped to present arms in the crisp three-count movement the Brits used. As the car stopped, a footman in livery pulled the door open. Getting out was the reverse of getting in. Ryan turned counterclockwise, stepped out backwards, and pulled his arm out behind. The footman grabbed his arm to help. Jack didn't want the help, but this wasn't a good time to object.
"You'll need a little practice on that," the Duke observed.
"I think you're right, sir." Jack followed him to the door, where another servant did his duty. "Tell me, Jack, first time we visited you, you seemed far more intimidated by the presence of the Queen than of me. Why is that?"
"Well, sir, you used to be a naval officer, right?"
"Of course."
The Duke turned and looked rather curious. Ryan grinned.
"Sir, I work at Annapolis. The Academy crawls with naval officers, and remember, I used to be a Marine. If I let myself get intimidated by every swabby who crossed my path, the Corps would come and take my sword back."
"You cheeky bugger!"
They both had a laugh. Ryan had expected to be impressed by the palace. Even so, it was all he could manage to keep from being overwhelmed. Half the world had once been run from this house, and in addition to what the royal family had acquired over the centuries, had come gifts from all over the world. Everywhere he looked, the wide corridors were decorated with too many masterpieces of painting and sculpture to count. The walls were mainly covered with ivory-colored silk brocaded with gold thread. The carpets, of course, were imperial scarlet over marble or parquet hardwood. The money manager that Jack had once been tried to calculate the value of it all. He overloaded after about 10 seconds. The paintings alone were so valuable that any attempt to sell them off would distort the world market in fine art. The gilt frames alone. Ryan shook his head, wishing he had the time to examine every painting. You could live here 5 years and not have time to appreciate it all. He almost fell behind, but managed to control his gawking and kept pace with the older man. Ryan's discomfiture was growing. To the Duke, this was home. Perhaps one so large as to be something of a nuisance, but nonetheless home. Routine. The Rubens masterpieces on the wall were part of the scenery, as familiar to him as the photographs of wife and kids on any man's office desk. To Ryan, the impact of where he was, an impact made all the more crushing by the trappings of wealth and power, made him want to shrink away to nothingness. It was one thing to take his chance on the street. The Marines, after all, had prepared and trained him for that. But this... "Get off it, Jack," he told himself. "They're a royal family, but they're not your royal family." This didn't work. They were a royal family. That was enough to lacerate most of his ego.
"Here we are," the Duke said after turning right through an open door. "This is the music room." It was about the size of the living dining room in Ryan's house, the only thing he had seen thus far that could be so compared with any part of his $300,000 home on Peregrine Cliff. The ceiling was higher here, domed with gold-leaf trim. There were about 30 people, Ryan judged, and the moment they entered, all conversation stopped. Everyone turned to stare at Ryan. Jack was sure they'd seen the Duke before, and his grotesque cast. He had a terrible urge to slink away. He needed a drink.
"If you'll excuse me for a moment, Jack, I must be off. Back in a few minutes."
"Thanks a lot," Ryan thought, as he nodded politely. "Now what do I do?"
"Good evening, Sir John," said a man in the uniform of a vice-admiral of the Royal Navy. Ryan tried not to let his relief show. Of course he'd been handed off to another custodian. He realized belatedly that lots of people came here for the first time. Some would need a little support while they got used to the idea of being in a palace, and there would be a procedure to take care of them. Jack took a closer look at the man's face as they shook hands. There was something familiar about it.
"I'm Basil Charleston."
"Aha! Good evening, sir." His first week at Langley, he'd seen the man, and his CIA escort had casually noted that this was B.C., or just C., the chief of the British Secret Intelligence Service, once known as MI6. "What are you doing here?"
"You must be thirsty." Another man arrived with a glass of champagne. "Hello. I'm Bill Holmes."
"You gentlemen work together?" Ryan sipped at the bubbling wine.
"Judge Moore told me you were a clever chap," Charleston observed.
"Excuse me? Judge who?"
"Nicely done, Dr. Ryan." Holmes smiled as he finished off his glass. "I understand that you used to play football. The American kind, that is. You were on the junior varsity team, weren't you?"
"Varsity and junior varsity. But only in high school. I wasn't big enough for college ball," Ryan said, trying to mask his uneasiness. Junior varsity was the project name under which he'd been called in to consult with CIA.
"And you wouldn't happen to know anything about the chap who wrote Agents and Agencies?"
Charleston smiled. Jack went rigid. "Admiral, I cannot talk about that without...
Copy number 16 is sitting on my desk. The good judge told me to tell you that you were free to talk about the smoking word processor."
Ryan let out a breath. The phrase must have come originally from James Greer. When Jack had made the Canary Trap proposal to the Deputy Director, Intelligence, Admiral James Greer had made a joke about it, using those words. Ryan was free to talk. Probably. His CIA security briefing had not exactly covered this situation.
"Excuse me, sir. Nobody ever told me that I was free to talk about that."
Charleston went from jovial to serious for a moment. "Don't apologize, lad. One is supposed to take matters of classification seriously. That paper you wrote was an excellent bit of detective work. One of our problems, as someone doubtless told you, is that we take in so much information now that the real problem is making sense of it all. Not easy to wade through all the muck and find the gleaming nugget. For the first time in the business, your report was first rate. What I didn't know about was this thing the judge called the Canary Trap. He said you could explain it better than he." Charleston waved for another glass. A footman, or some sort of servant, came over with a tray.
"You know who I am, of course."
"Yes, Admiral. I saw you last July at the agency. You were getting out of the executive elevator on the 7th floor when I was coming out of the DDI's office, and somebody told me who you were."
"Good. Now you know that all of this remains in the family. What the devil is this Canary Trap?"
"Well, you know about all the problems CIA has with leaks. When I was finishing off the first draft of the report, I came up with an idea to make each one unique.
They've been doing that for years, Holmes noted. All one must do is misplace a comma here and there. Easiest thing in the world. If the news people are foolish enough to print a photograph of the document, we can identify the leak.
Yes, sir. And the reporters who publish the leaks know that, too. They've learned not to show photographs of the documents they get from their sources, haven't they? Ryan answered.